Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. Yeah.
There it is.
This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here, the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. For purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
That's right. And on this particular podcast, you, yes you, or people very much like you.
Or you, the one sitting next to you.
Basically anyone listening or not can email us.
If you're not listening, you can email us.
You can still email us. Anyone can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. There's no bravado like false bravado, isn't there? Anyway, you can email us. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is our email address. I can only keep that level of confidence up for like a minute. And you can ask us questions. You can critique our critiques. You can pry at our brains with crowbars of the mind. You can ask us silly questions. You can ask us serious questions. You can talk about film criticism, entertainment history, or just whatever you would like us to speak upon. That's what we do. We podcast, and we talk about movies, and sometimes TV, because we love those things. And we don't like dilly-dallying right up at the front of the podcast. So without further thingy.
Ado.
Sure.
It's not, it's ado, by the way, as in much ado, A-D-O. It's not A-D-I-E-U.
Yeah, I saw someone use that.
It's the French word for farewell.
Yeah, I saw someone refer to it as, you know, without further adieu. And I'm like,
it's a ado, different word. Yeah. As in without doing anything more, without further doings.
Yeah, doings will no longer transpire. Instead, we will answer these letters.
No more ado. Anyway, here's some letters. Let's just get started here.
Why do we record these podcasts so late? We're so groggy.
We just need to start to, you know, mainlining tea. Yeah. Here's a letter from Cecil.
Hi, Cecil.
Hi, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. Rain Man is a terrible, terrible, terrible movie.
All right.
I haven't seen Rain Man.
I haven't seen it in many years.
It's a hole in my film education. I think it might be because whenever anybody depicts a character with autism, they exclusively, for 100% of the research, just watch the movie Rain Man. Music is garbage, for example. Did you see Music?
I did not see Music.
Yeah, I just heard horrible things about Music. That's the Saya-directed film.
Yeah.
When it comes to autism, I can't think of any movie that does it well. The only purposefully autistic character I can think of that works well is Julia from Sesame Street. She is kind and is just a kid and has friends and all is good. The fact that the one good autistic character is in a show which partnered with Autism Speaks, a terrible charity run by idiots, is annoying. The context sucks, but the character is good and clearly they did more than just watch Rain Man. Star Trek has great accidentally autistic characters. These characters are the creators and the actors said we didn't intend them to be read that way, but we love that people get that from them. The characters like Data, Spock, Lieutenant Barkley, and the character who has my type of autism from Star Trek Discovery, Ensign Tilly. Are there any good characters that have autism and not savant syndrome? Thanks, Cecil. If you use differently abled instead of disabled, I will never speak to you again.
Noted. First off, that's a great question. And one thing that I love that we have been doing more and more and more in the critical community and indeed the mainstream audience as well is talking in greater depth about representation and particularly what kind of representation, not just the existence of representation, but what is accurate representation, what is fair representation, what is actually helpful representation. Yeah. And unfortunately, I've known autistic people, but I'm not really, I wouldn't say I'm qualified personally, because I'm not autistic, to say what are the best representations of autistic people in film and television.
Unfortunately, same. Yeah. I have heard from other non-autistic people what the accurate depictions might be, but I'm not hearing that from autistic people,
exactly.
From people on the spectrum who say that was my experience. This is the accurate version of this. So I would only be getting it hearsay anyway.
Yeah.
So I can't say.
I think it's important to when people who are in a position to, you know, we have a, this is a letters podcast. You ask us questions about things about the entertainment industry. I think it's important to be able to say that's something I am not an expert in. Hmm. Not just to come up with an answer for you. Not just to pretend that we know everything about everything. We don't. What I would like to say is that if anyone listening, if any one of our listeners is autistic or feels that they have a particular level of expertise in autism that would be relevant, has suggestions of positive portrayals and not just positive, but fair, helpful portrayals of autistic people in entertainment, please let us know. And we would love to amplify that, and we'd love to maybe share those stories and try to help call attention and highlight film and TV that does it right. Because sometimes it's not the most popular films that do so. Sometimes it's not the most popular TV series. Sometimes they fly under the radar.
Yeah, yeah.
And this could be a great example or a great opportunity to boost shows and movies that have actually put forth the effort and done it right.
Yeah, I can point out ones that I know definitely get it wrong. The one that leaps to mind was, and this was such a bummer because I'm actually a big Shane Black fan, but Shane Black wrote and directed a Predator sequel. I think it was just called The Predator, which featured an autistic child as one of the characters. And A, it was, like you said, a listener, it was savant syndrome, you know, that which is like such a lazy plot point that so many screenwriters just sort of lean into. And it depicted being on the spectrum as being this sort of like anti-alien superpower. It was like most offensive thing.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about the kid and the Predator and how they were like, this is the next evolution of humanity.
Now
you are all powerful.
It's not a kid who's on the spectrum. It turns out, you're evolving into this new being. It's like, shut up. You know nothing about this, Shane Black.
Again, I feel like that was an incredibly naive attempt to be positive, and ultimately all you were really accomplishing was a different kind of dehumanization. That's one. We just put out a call for people to send us good examples and talk about the absolute fastest response ever. I just got a text from my wife and partner, Michelle.
Who's listening to us speaking from the other room.
We're very loud, and sometimes you can hear us in the other parts of the apartment. She pointed out that the autistic community, there's been a lot of appreciation of the character of Entrapta in She-Ra, the new reboot version of a She-Ra on Netflix. And although I don't think she has been specifically codified in the show as autistic, she definitely presents many of those qualities. And she's a great character. I love that character. But again, it's not really my place to say.
I've heard mixed things about the Netflix series Atypical as well. But I haven't seen it, so I can't say. Again, hearsay, rumor, passing on what I've heard from others. I can't take my word for it, unfortunately.
So again, this is one where we're a bit at a loss, but thank you for raising the issue. We're glad we can, we're glad we can give that a platform. And again, anyone who is autistic or has a lot of personal experience with it, possibly, if you want to email us, the email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We would love to hear from you. We want to know what TV shows and movies have been doing the representation fairly, appropriately, and positively. So thank you. Let's move on.
Here's another letter. Here's a letter from Justin.
Hi, Justin.
Hi, Justin. Dear Bibbs and X squared plus 3X plus 16 equals Rockmeister McCool. I am a quadratic formula. I recently watched John Waters' Hairspray.
Ooh.
And I do enjoy the 2000 remake as well, but I was curious, which do you prefer and why? How would you compare them? For me, I think Waters' take just edges it out for me as the favorite, but I do have a bias toward weirder movies, and Waters' take has a wig bomb. So anyway, what are your thoughts? thank you for all you do, Justin.
I've actually never seen all of the remake movie. Nor have I actually gone to see the stage play. I grew up watching Hairspray a lot. It's been a long time since I've actually sat down and watched the whole thing. But I loved it. I always really just glommed onto its infectious positivity and its it's weird because so much of John Waters' career was spent sort of looking with sort of beatific eyes at the weird and sometimes the genuinely off-putting. And he just has so much affection for them. And Hairspray is, in many respects, his most accessible movie.
It's rated PG.
It's rated PG. Yeah. It's not trying to push you away at all, but he's still got that exact same lens, that exact same absolute loving portrayal of characters who, in other movies, wouldn't get the main stage. A character like Ricky Lake's, what's her name?
Tracy Turnblad.
A character like Tracy Turnblad would not be the protagonist in almost any other teen movie of the 80s.
Yeah.
Just by virtue of the fact that she's not thin. Let's just be fair. And she's an awesome character, and I love her to pieces, and I love her story, and that's a great movie. I saw bits of the remake, and I thought this is okay, but it kind of missed the... It felt to me a little too shiny. I don't know.
It missed the local authenticity of actually filming in the streets of Baltimore. There's a scene in the original where John Waters has Edith Massey plays a thrift store owner, and her goal is to clothe the homeless.
Yeah.
So she offers just sort of like the weirdest possible clothes for like a penny. It's like almost no money at all, and. That sort of like we're looking out for the outsiders. We're looking out for the people that other people have ignored. That sort of attitude, I think, is really missing from the.
Was it Shankman who directed that one?
Yeah, I think it was Shankman.
Yeah,
from that version of it. When Divine plays the mom, that's John Waters and Divine making another movie together. When John Travolta plays Edna Turnblad, that's a fun stunt.
They're being kitschy.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't it funny that John Travolta's doing it? Whereas that's him playing a role. Divine was Divine.
Divine was just like
Divine was playing herself.
Yeah,
and everything.
And had another role in Hairspray.
That's true. Yeah,
Divine played two roles in that movie. John Waters is in that movie, and he actually had a cameo. I think it's the only film of his where he appears on screen.
Really?
I think he's had, like, he played the voice of, I think it was John Wayne Gacy in Serial Mom.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, there's a bit where they discover Kathleen Turner's, like, store of serial killer memorabilia, because she's, like, really into serial killers.
Yeah.
And one of them is like a recording saying like, oh, this is the recording of a horrible serial killer. And that was John Waters' voice. He was the voice on the tape. It was either John Wayne Gacy or it was Ted Bundy. It was some famous serial murderer.
It looks like he was a voice in Pink Flamingos. He was the voice in Serial Mom.
He was the announcer in Pink Flamingos.
He was a voice in Pecker.
Oh, yeah, he was the dirty phone caller in Pecker.
Oh, it looks like he was a reporter in Cecil B. Demented, although I don't remember that at all.
We watched that recently.
I don't remember
seeing him on screen in that one.
But yeah.
All right. So, yeah, I adore John Waters. I love the original Hairspray because it's sort of down and dirty, because it is incredibly positive, and because it captures a sort of local... pop culture phenomenon that we don't really talk about anymore because pop culture phenomena are now global. It's kind of hard for a global audience to understand the intense love for local pop culture and the corny Collins show in the world of Hairspray was a very real thing. These sort of local dance programs where everybody in town could conceivably appear on that show. And it was a big deal if you got to be on that show, but it only
reached as far as your city or county.
Only broadcast locally, but in that county, it was everything.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing is true of a horror hosts, a phenomenon that I'm very fond of.
It's weird because, like, the phenomenon of, like, that kind of, like, DIY TV host celebrity phenomenon, that exists, but it's gone global because it's YouTube now.
Yeah.
Like, but it used to be a very local phenomenon. It would just be like, these are people in your neighborhood.
You could only see it in Baltimore. Yeah. You could only see it in this small
public
town.
Public access TV.
I remember going, I went on vacation to Solvang, California, and through some weird fluke of satellite images, we were able to get local access midnight movie program from New York.
Oh.
It's from like there were ads for like local businesses in Brooklyn. And we were able to watch Village of the Giants in between the horror host kind of introducing things and saying, yeah, and come on down to Vinny's Pizza here in Brooklyn. It's clearly some guy with a video camera shooting his own commercial. That was really special. That was a fun night. And this was just like a couple of years ago, too.
That's hilarious.
So it still exists, but it's not the preferred mode of consumption any longer.
Anyway, we're off the beaten path.
Well, so, no, it goes to Hairspray, though. That's what I like about Hairspray is it, I think, presents that kind of local celebrity phenomenon way better than the stage musical does.
Well, again, I think that's what I was getting at. Yeah. Is I like Adam Shankman fine, I guess, as a director, but he's not about any sort of realism, is he? He's about sort of the showmanship.
Yeah, well,
of it. And there's something
arguably John Waters isn't either, but he's authentic.
That's my point. I think that authenticity comes out. Like, yeah, John Waters is arch. Certainly, but he's presenting that world of archness from a place where I understand every single detail of this because it's based on something real. Whereas I feel like a lot of Adam Shankman joints are, they're based on the stage.
Yeah.
And there's a certain level of artificiality that's caked into it, and sometimes that's fine. But also sometimes it just feels a little phony, and that's why I ended up not finishing that version of Hairspray. I wasn't a film critic when that came out. Right. If I were watching it now, I would have sat through the whole thing on principle, so I could confidently answer a question like this.
Right.
But I never got around to it, so what can I do?
I agree. I like the musical just fine. The musical, it's just not weird enough, though. It doesn't have a divine. Debbie Harry's in the original, for goodness sake. Meng Stoll's in the original. You know, you get these really interesting people playing all these parts.
All right.
Here's a letter from Alex. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Alex.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I fell down an IMDb rabbit hole a while back and stumbled across a remarkably interesting oddity, Josh Kirby the Time Warrior. That is Josh Kirby ellipsis the Time Warrior exclamation point. The six chapters, Planet of the Dino Knights, The Human Pets, Trapped on Toy World, Eggs from 70 million BC, Journey to the Magic Cavern, and Last Battle for the Universe, all of them 86 to 90 minutes apiece, were released over the course of 7 months between 95 and 96, and boy howdy is it ever 90s. The MacGuffin of the series is a device capable of destroying the universe, which is called the Nullifier, and should be in no way compared to the Ultimate Nullifier, created by Jack Kirby in the 1960s. Said MacGuffin is broken up into pieces and hit throughout time and space by the Fourth Doctor, I'm sorry, Irwin 1138. Our Mary Sue is Josh Kirby, a half-human warrior from the 32nd century, rounded out by companions who must keep the pieces of the MacGuffin out of the clutches of the zany bad guy Dr. Zoetrope. And then they get in this spaceship and... sounds pretty wild. Despite the flagrant ripoffs poorly disguised as homage, the series has oodles of practical sets, costumes, and effects that that put one in mind of recreational drugs. The world-building and mythology include the warrior character's interesting slash ridiculous moral code, the 21 Codes of Kang, which contains idioms like, those who abandon the truth once may never find it again, or, if you lay claim to a title, be prepared to defend it at any hour, day or night. The series was brought to us by Moonbeam Entertainment. Do you know Moonbeam, right?
They're a subsidiary of Full Moon.
That's right.
Full Moon is a mostly straight to... They did some theatrical releases in the 80s, but mostly straight to video, horror, sci-fi genre releasing company. They're best known for doing the Puppet Master movies, but they have also tinkered in kids' movies as well. Probably the best known kids' movie is the Pre-Hysteria series, which were about little dinosaurs.
Put out by Moonbeam of Pre-Hysteria fame,
which
is a subsidiary of Full Moon, which is a subsidiary of Paramount. You won't find this curio on Paramount Plus, though, but it's on Roku. because I feel contractually obligated to include a question in these emails, I'll segue. You talk about shows that last one season or less on Cancel Too Soon, and have plenty of opportunities to talk movies on critically acclaimed, but I feel like you do not get to talk about miniseries that had a pre-planned ending short of a traditional season. I feel like this was prominent in anime, with many OVAs from the 90s and 2000s. I don't know what OVA stands for.
Oh, it's... I'll look that up.
All right.
Before
released, consisting 3 to 6 half-hour segments. Amongst these, I would recommend Deep Sub number 6, Read or Die, or Furikuri. I've seen Furikuri.
I've seen Read or Die, and I liked it mostly. Right.
Also, Broken Saints.
Is OVA stands for Original Video Animation.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, they were designed to basically straight to video, but they were very often designed to be episodic. They would have, like, the opening and closing credits. They would be serialized, even though they didn't have to be, possibly because they could be done on second run later. But, yeah.
I would recommend Broken Saints was a web series consisting of 24 chapters, anywhere from 9 to 83 minutes, 12 hours total. Do you have any miniseries or serialized stories like Josh Kirby, The Time Warrior, that don't neatly fall into your other podcasts that you would like to talk about or recommend to your listeners? Thanks as always. I really appreciate the balance of entertainment and education I derive from your plethora of podcasts. And I'm looking forward to celebrating my 1-year Patreon anniversary next month.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
Anniversary. Keep up the good works. Yours, Alex the Geek Librarian. P.S. It would be awesome if you did a Hoopla theme on the Patreon poll. Hoopla theme.
Hoopla. Oh, Hoopla's a streaming service.
Oh, okay.
I forgot about that for a second. It's not talked about as often. We'll take note of that. That's a good point. Okay, so first off, Josh Kirby, Time Warrior. I have a lot of affection for earlier eras of Full Moon Entertainment when it felt like they were trying harder.
the first two, maybe three Puppet Master movies are legit.
They're pretty good.
The second is my favorite. The third's pretty good too.
Yeah, they're all very, very watchable and entertaining. And I would recommend all of them. A lot of the early Full Moon stuff was made by people with some real ambition and had a little money behind them. I would really recommend the Oblivion series. I think there were only two.
The original Cowboys and Aliens.
Yeah.
Which is a sticker, a huge sticker they put on the DVD boxes when the movie Cowboys and Aliens came out.
It takes place on an alien planet, and it's totally a Western. They used all these Western sets, but in this Western
locale. It's like sheriffs and horses.
Yeah, but it's full of aliens and ray guns and stuff. And it was, I think they were both written by Peter David, this award-winning comic book writer who worked on The Hulk and X-Factor and a lot of other great comics.
Big fan of Peter David.
So it's an unusually well-written a couple of Full Moon movies, and they threw a little money at the makeup effects and everything, and it looks pretty good.
Yeah.
So every once in a while, you'll find, like, some real gems in that 80s, 90s era of Full Moon. I've looked. I mean, I haven't looked consistently, because who has the time? They're actually very prolific. I have not found any gems from Full Moon in a very long time.
No. A friend of mine came over, and just sort of on a fluke, I think they were all in a box for like $3 at Best Buy. He bought the Ginger Dead Man movies that had been made to date.
They're not very good.
The second Ginger Dead Man movie is, it's like offensively awful. It's like one of just literally the worst that I've seen.
I think the first Ginger Dead Man is kind of amusing, if only because they got Gary Busey to play the Ginger Dead. Yeah. Ginger Dead Man is about a mass murderer who dies and then ends up...
His blood drips into some...
Cookie batter.
Cookie batter at a bakery.
Yeah, and then he ends up being turned into a killer gingerbread cookie. And late at night at a bakery, a few teenagers are, like, doing teenager stuff. You know how they are.
And, sneaking into bakeries and all.
Yeah, and they all... And the bakery, of course, is big enough that you can hide stuff because it's the bakery in your local town. And anyway, he kills a bunch of people, and it's like,
it's a little living gingerbread man.
Yeah, and they made a whole bunch of sequels. I've seen at least two of them. They're not good. The first one isn't good either, but it's at least a fun watch, I guess. It's probably the most recent,
I think there's
halfway decent Full Moon I've seen.
I don't remember. I think there's 4 or 5 Ginger Dead Man solo movies, and there's a... Ginger Dead Man meets Evil Bong crossover film.
Yes.
There's and 7 That's, Evil Bong movies.
Evil Bong is a franchise about a Bong who is evil.
It's a living Bong.
Yeah. And no, I didn't say that is evil. Yeah. Who is evil? Evil Bong.
You have an Evil Bong. Is it a functional Evil Bong or is it just a statue?
It's just a statue. In fact, we actually interviewed Charles Band once. And he actually, because Full Moon Features was located in downtown L.A.
We contacted him on Facebook or something. Say, hey, you want an interview? He's like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, they were chill. Mm-hmm. And we went there. And while we were there, it's like, hey, we got all this like crap lying around. Like, you want like... some like leftover merch or whatever, and I was like, okay. Sure, and they let me have an Evil Bong, and it's not a functional bong, but it is neat. So yeah, I have that.
I have a statue on my desk, and I don't want to say its name just because it's incredibly rude, but I still have it. I still have my statue that there I got from
anyway
Full Moon Entertainment.
We digress. I haven't seen the Josh Kirby movies. Actually, I was meant to get around to them when we were doing the two shot We would, like, every month or so do an entire movie franchise, and I actually always meant to get around to Josh Kirby, because there's a surprising number of those films. Chris McCarpenter is in those. But the question about miniseries, which is, it used to be that the sort of differentiation between, like, movie and television was a little clearer. Movies were individual standalones. If there was a sequel, the sequel was also kind of designed to stand alone, usually. And television was serialized, episodic, and there wasn't a lot of crossover. And then there were miniseries, which was just TV, but it was designed to end after four or five episodes. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of good miniseries. Some of my favorites, I'm really quite fond of in the 1990s, there was this big push for epic miniseries, usually like adaptations of fantasy.
I think it was it Hallmark who was doing the big push? I guess it was like Showtime, and a lot of the cable networks were pushing forward these things.
Yeah, the cable networks were doing like a lot of like the big like Civil War movies, but
Andersonville, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
the Blue and the Gray.
Gods and Generals actually ended up being a movie, but there was a lot of those. This was like network TV, and I think Hallmark did it, but I think it aired on like NBC or something. But the big one that like kicked off the trend was Gulliver's Travels, starring Ted Danson.
That was not on network TV.
Are you sure?
I'm fairly certain.
I'm going to look that up because I really thought it was.
Because I remember wanting to see it, and I never had cable growing up, so I didn't have access to it until later.
Okay. Well, in any case, I'm looking this crap up.
There was a TV miniseries of Gulliver's Travels in like 1995 or 6.
It aired on NBC.
Oh, it did? Okay.
I'm sure it repeated elsewhere, but it aired on NBC.
Well, paint me asshole. All right.
and it was from Hallmark and Jim Henson, so they had some real talent behind that one. But the one of the ones that came in its wake, which I'm very fond of, is the TV miniseries of Merlin, starring Sam Neill.
Which I haven't seen.
Which is actually a pretty respectable King Arthur adaptation. Like all King Arthur adaptations, it mucks around with the myth, but the myth has been pre-mucked with.
Right.
Over many centuries. There's no, like... No one's ever done, like, the original, so I'm not going to be too precious about it. But I'm quite fond of it. I think that one actually holds up pretty good. Obviously, the visual effects are dated, but the cast is solid. You got
Miranda Richardson.
Richardson, thank you. You got Miranda Richardson. You got Martin Short. Sam Neill, obviously. It's really quite good.
Yeah. Warwick Davis is in it.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Brobdingnag. It's one of the Brobdingnagians.
Yeah. No, you're thinking of Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah. Oh, you were talking about Merlin.
I was still talking about Merlin. Sorry. Warwick Davis isn't Gulliver. That's also a good one. And on the higher end of the listing, like the more fancy, more expensive, I'm a really, really big fan of an HBO miniseries that kind of came and went, and then it was like around the same time that The Hurt Locker came out.
Okay.
So everyone was talking about The Hurt Locker as this like incredible representation of like
soldiers'
experience in contemporary warfare. But because I had seen the HBO miniseries Generation Kill, Hurt Locker was more like pretty dang good. I actually think Generation Kill is like, it's got this wonderful catch-22 quality to it. It just completely understands the absurdity of how bureaucracy and the boots on the ground approach are completely at war with each other.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what that whole miniseries is about. Really amazing cast. It's really great. What about you? What about some miniseries that you dig?
I grew up watching a lot of sort of the stuffier British stuff that just sort of drifted into my field of vision. I'm very fond of I, Claudius. I don't think I really have to recommend I, Claudius, but maybe I do. Maybe it's obscure enough.
I don't think it doesn't air very often. I don't think people talk about it too often anymore.
This was a British miniseries from the early 80s based on a novel by Robert Graves, based on actual Roman history of Emperor Claudius I, who was the one like decent emperor that ruled in between Caligula and Nero.
Yeah.
So there's just like chaos on either side. But yeah, it was about... They restaged the rise to power of these Roman rulers as a soap opera, essentially, and sort of family play and all of these, you know, rumors and weird details about Roman history. It gets Roman history really right.
Hmm.
To the point where they showed it to us in high school. And which was actually like a bit of a treat for us because, you know, there's like cussing and violence and nudity. It's like, we get to see this in school. This is awesome. So yeah, I really, really like I, Claudius. It's probably on BritBox. I'm sure you can find that online somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure it's available.
Yeah, I, Claudius. And also The Prisoner. I remember when in my early 20s, I got deep into The Prisoner. Which, you know, some people say, was that a one-season wonder? Was it a miniseries? Well, they did conclude it, and
a lot of British TV was designed to end.
They talk about how it was never intended to go for longer than it did, which, you know, I'm okay with that. We covered... We covered a couple because for a while there, our TV movies also included a few miniseries if we could get around to them.
One of our first things we ever did on our Patreon was the Cancel Too Soon Monthly Movie, in which we talked about TV movies, but also occasionally some miniseries. Probably the most prominent one we did was Lonesome Dove from 1989, which is one of the more celebrated TV miniseries ever. And we actually had a special guest for that, Rhett Reese, the co-writer of the Deadpool movies.
Yeah.
Who was a big fan.
Also a big fan of Lonesome Dove.
Yeah, I'd interviewed him a few times, and he was...
You want to come, Lonesome Dove with us?
So that was a really... And that movie holds up really good, actually.
Yeah, It looks like it was shot in a public park, but it's actually really well written.
I appreciate Lonesome Dove because where it begins has nothing to do with where it ends. Like, you think you know what you're watching, and then, like, an hour later, it's something completely different, and an hour later, it's something completely different, and it really feels epic.
And we also talked about a miniseries... that came in the wake of Twin Peaks called Wild Palms. It was like Oliver Stone. He's the executive producer on that one. And that was sort of his attempt to capture sort of the Twin Peaks audience. So he made this really bizarre science fiction thing about how it's like the near future and everybody has holographic TVs, but it's all part of this like drug conspiracy and these two like warring political factions who are being covered up by this holographic TV technology.
It's super weird.
And yeah, there's like nightmares and visions have a lot to do with it.
If it came out today, it would definitely find an audience quickly, but it also, I'm still not 100% sure it'd be good because it's super fucking off-putting and strange.
Yeah, it's really like, I think it's really bracing. I recommend you see it. I think there's a lot to chew on. I think our conversation about it was really interesting.
Yeah. It's difficult to say
whether or not it's good.
It's one of those TV miniseries where you're not sure if it deserves a Criterion Collection or a Vinegar Syndrome release.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
It's one or the other, possibly both.
So yeah, if you can track it, I bet you can find that on like YouTube or something.
Somebody's plucked up
Wild Palms. Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting one.
Super strange. But yeah, there's a lot out there, and it's interesting because now that we have these sort of event television. Shows, the miniseries has kind of like, it's still a miniseries, but they just have taken on this new air of respectability, I think.
Well, like, from what I understand, a lot of these Marvel superhero TV series, like, aren't, they're meant like sort of like these stopgap TV events. They're miniseries that they're releasing instead of feature films.
Yeah, like WandaVision. You could do like the Falcon and the Winter Soldier more of it because it's just two heroes.
Falcon and the Snowman. I did it again.
But WandaVision, the very specific framework of that show, that story's been told. Like, you can't quite go back to that without like. Really bending over backwards. And that was a really cool miniseries. I actually really liked that one. Right. So, there's a lot to be done with the format. And, we could go on, but we should answer some more letters.
All right. Here's a letter from Edward. Hello, Edward. Greetings to the irrepressible Ultra Bibs and Professor Psy P.S.Y. Bold. Should just change my spelling to P.S.Y. Bold.
It works.
People would pronounce it correctly for one.
But then they'll think you have powers.
But I do.
Never mind.
Maximilian Ibn Fabuloso here, but you may call me Edward. This is a bit of a throwback letter. Sometimes I move a bit slower than originally intended, but since the other half is doing his Disney thing, this gives me a chance to work on catching up.
Okay.
First, Jim Steinman. While I can't think of anything that he scored for film that you don't already know, I was curious if you knew his three theatrical forays. The most popular would be Whistle Down the Wind with Andrew Lloyd Webber. It was based on the 1961 movie, and the concept album created a hit for the group Boyzone called No Matter What. He also did a musical called Tanz der Vampire. Dance of the Vampire was the Broadway version. with book by Michael Kunze, this time based on the Roman Polanski movie. If you are a big Steinman fan, this will come off as a Steinman songbook using many of his previous works, including Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yep.
And Tonight Was What It Means to Be Young. Mm. It was a hit in Germany, but it never worked on Broadway, even with Michael Crawford's, quote, input. And I'm not sure that the CD was ever released of it, although there was an English version of the German show. Broadway and Michael Crawford made changes, of course. And I did manage to get a copy of that during a brief moment of availability. If desired, I could make a copy and send it to you completely.
I am very interested. I'm not going to lie.
I'd love to see that. I don't know if we could cover it, but I'd be interested to watch it.
Yeah.
And finally, there's another project I know about that sadly never made it, Batman the Musical. This seems to have been a doomed project that he never let die. I have some of the songs somewhere, but somehow it's not on my computer. A lot of the songs appear to be available on YouTube. He was releasing stuff about it all the time, so these might be good recordings. I do remember liking the music more than Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, but that isn't a very high bar.
If any superhero deserves a rock opera, I think it's Batman. No superhero takes himself more seriously. And that's the sort of character who would sing about himself. Yeah. And yet there's something just wonderfully just contrasting in tone that I love. I would have killed to have seen Jim Steinman do a Batman opera.
I thought that was a joke. Like, I saw the poster for it. Really? Somebody put together a promotional poster. It's the Batman symbol. It's like, music by Jim Steinman. It's like, oh, somebody's funning on me. Turns out that was a real thing. Jim Steinman was working on a Batman Broadway show.
Yeah.
Would that have been good? No.
Would it have been amazing?
Yeah.
Yes. I would have killed to have seen that.
I saw Spider-Man on Broadway. That's one of the feathers in my cap. I can flaunt that. And it was total coincidence. I'll stop the letter for a minute just for the brief story.
Oh, there's more. Okay.
My wife and I went to New York. She had like a work trip and she brought me along so we could just play around in New York for a little bit. But she said, the morning she was going off to work, she said, your job is to just get Broadway show tickets. Just go from theater to theater in person and just buy something. And we went to see Spider-Man, and the tickets were ungodly expensive. It was $400 to sit in the orchestra, and we're not going to pay that much to see the Spider-Man musical.
Yeah.
But as I was going into the lobby just to look at the prices, somebody said, well, we had this group of 12, but only 10 of us can show. Can I get a refund? And they said, sorry, no refunds. So I just shouted out, I'll buy those off you. I'll give you cash. And they followed me to a cash machine. I just handed them cash. So we were able to see, I got a pair of Spider-Man tickets for $100, which is a steal. For the pair.
Wow.
That's a steal.
That's
for
enormous steal.
For orchestra pit seats for the hottest show on Broadway.
That's amazing.
So we were able to see for real, real cheap the Spider-Man Broadway musical written by Bono and directed kind of by Julie Taymor.
Yeah.
Julie Taymor was fired off the project because she had all these really weird ideas about what Spider-Man should be.
You can see clips online. It's amazing. I would like to say this. I find it fascinating that, like, oh, I'm sorry, we can't see the show. Like, I'm sorry, we don't do refunds. You have to scalp them.
Yeah, pretty much.
Go scalping.
Go, go. That's,
they dare you.
It's a New York experience. So, yeah, we got to see Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. And Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark... sucks.
I've heard from the music, it's not good.
It's not as bad as its reputation might have you believe. And no one got injured. That's all anybody asked, because it was really notorious for injuring a lot of the stunt performers during early shows.
But not during the actual performances. It seemed like that was...
When we told people, we saw Spider-Man, the first question was, ooh, did you see anybody get injured? It's like, no. Actually,
no, and why is that important to you? Why is that like, ooh, tell me.
But it felt more like one of those like amusement park stunt spectacular attractions than it did an actual Broadway show.
Nice.
But yeah, I wish I could have seen Julie Taymor's version, which had all these like allusions to Ovid and the Metamorphosis, and like she tried to make it feel really Greek. That was her idea. Spider-Man is a reference to Ovid's Metamorphosis, or Ovid's Roman. Ovid's Metamorphosis.
Regardless, very few people could have had the clout to do that. Mm-hmm. To take Spider-Man and got a completely weird direction and this ginormous production. Was it music by Bono, right?
Bono on the Edge, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to make it weird. Like, we're not going to do the Spider-Man you know and like. We're going to do the Spider-Man you don't know and don't like. And you're going to love it. Oh, you don't love it. Oh.
And Kraven the Hunter is half lion in this version.
Well, that's actually...
Carnage is made of blood. And here's a character called...
Carnage was made of blood.
Well, in the comics, it's like an alien glob.
Yeah, but the alien got into his blood. Like, it's actually inside of him. Like, that was one of the things with Carnage. Also, there are versions of Kraven the Hunter where he did turn into an animal guy.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm just saying those aren't the things to point out. No. Those aren't the ones that are the
Although they invented They invented a new villain character called Swissmiss, who is like half Swiss Army knife.
Yes.
And that's a character I don't think they've ever done anything with in the comics.
I would do
Imagine
it.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Anyway, finish the letter. I have a point. I have a question I want to make. Yeah.
More of the letter. Next, Xanadu. Not everyone was asking for it, but I think maybe we've been looking at Xanadu, that is the feature film, in the wrong light. While we sadly didn't get the originally intended version when Andy Gibb didn't sign on, and only on-the-fly rewrites are all over this movie, including why would Sonny, a painter, have access to a high-tech recording studio? The writers went down to the next best route, a musical review. If you think about it, the story exists just enough to get from one song to the next. Flimsy stories are common in musical reviews.
Yep.
The focus is the musical numbers, which is exactly why they put all of the effort into those. It is difficult to find fault in the musical numbers, although opinions vary on the Gene Kelly, Olivia Newton-John scene.
It's well-intentioned, but it's... And certainly the idea is fine, but it doesn't quite play. Whatever, let's move on.
Does this make it a great movie? No, that is, but that's not unusual with reviews. I argue that it is actually quite successful as a musical review. Before presenting this idea to you two, I made sure to bounce off of the musical theater queen other half, who would not hesitate to tell me that I was just wrong, and he agreed that it worked as a musical review.
Okay.
Sometimes I are smart. Are there movies you can think of that when they came, if you came at them from a different angle, you found you thought of them as a better movie? I still think that Tammy works much better when you watch it as a drama other than a comedy. Hmm. And there's also a third part to this letter.
Oh, but, Tammy, the Melissa McCarthy movie. Yeah, I actually agree with that.
Both you and a friend of mine suggested that Batman and Robin works really well as a luchador film.
Yeah.
That's a good way to look at that movie. It still doesn't make it enjoyable, but at least it makes sense. A broader context.
Yeah, it's much more like, it's not about being a gritty superhero movie, it's about being a larger-than-life sort of heightened reality action movie. And, I found a certain level of appreciation for it on that level. A couple of things. Before we get in, is that the end of the email?
No, there's a little bit more.
There's so much. You covered so many points. I want to mention a few things in the Jim Steinman stuff. But anyway, let's move on. Let's finish the email.
All right. Part three is A Cry for Help. I'm still going crazy trying to remember these two movies, and I'm really hoping that you or your extensive knowledge of your base might be able to solve these mysteries. The first one I'm fairly certain is going to be easy. The second one has been driving me crazy for years. Number one, a thriller. I'm fairly certain. Someone is attacked in their apartment, and as part of their decor that they have, part of the decor they have on their table legs are large open scissors. So, of course, this is how they ultimately die, possibly decapitated, assisted death by lousy feng shui. You're thinking of the movie Dead Again.
Yes.
I
think you're right.
It's a Kenneth Branagh movie, and there's a climactic scene where an artist whose métier is scissors has a lot of scissors around their apartment.
There's a lot of scissors imagery in that movie because it's about like people who are reliving like past crimes from previous lives.
Yeah.
And the past crimes involved scissors. And it's really good, a movie, actually.
Dead Again deserves a Criterion release. I'll just say that. It's actually like impeccably written.
Yeah.
It's really well directed.
It's Kenneth Branagh's most underrated movie. And it's not even underrated because everyone who sees it loves it. Just no one sees it. That's the problem.
Well, it was a mild hit like at the time. It came out in like 91 around there. But
it was actually rather noteworthy in that people started like looking at Robin Williams a little differently afterwards because he had a more serious supporting role in it, and it was really good. Yeah, that movie's great. Yeah. But that's I'm 99% sure that's the movie.
You're probably thinking of the film Dead Again.
Yeah.
And here's the hard one, a period piece, I think from World War II era France. A woman and her husband live above and run a fancy shop with their daughter. He is unable to fight in the war. Then there is a drifter or a deserter who is hired by the wife to clean up the shop and given a mattress on the basement to sleep on. And of course, they have a torrid affair. Then he threatens to leave when she tries to get a little tough with him, and he tells her that he will only stay if she arranges for her daughter to sleep with him too. No, no, you mustn't ask. I can't. Honey, go clean up. The man from downstairs is going to deflower you so mommy can still get some. Ooh, that's pretty twisted premise. Then
really, really horrifying.
Somehow he ends up sleeping with both the mother and the daughter while the husband, who knows what is going on, cries alone in bed. Then the city is bombed and everyone dies. The end.
Jesus
Christ! What a delightful movie. I hated this movie so much. when I was invited to see it, and I don't think I want to see it again, but I really like to know the movie's name so I can tell people what one of the worst movies I've ever seen was. Well, that's it for now. Thank you both for your time. How you find time to sleep is a mystery, and
we just don't.
And I hope you and those you care about have a great day. Oh, and why, yes, I can't speak cat, so meow, meow. Stay healthy and happy, Edward. Well, thank you for the extensive letter and giving us a lot to talk about.
There's a lot in there.
Does sound a little familiar.
Not for me.
It sounds a little bit like Shame, but there's no daughter character like the Ingmar Bergman film Shame. No, Skaman. But yeah, there's actually no daughter character.
I'd be curious. So one thing that wasn't in the email is whether it was in the English language or not.
Yeah, if it's an English or a French film.
So I'd be curious about that. That might actually change my framework and how I would look that up. But that one doesn't ring a bell. If anyone knows what movie we're talking about, please let us know. The fastest way to do that would be let us know on Twitter at Critic Acclaim, or I'm at William DeBiani. Mm. He's at William Seibold. If you know what movie we're talking about or he's talking about there, that's the way to go. Regarding some of the other stuff, first off, Jim Steinman. So many unrealized Jim Steinman projects. And I remember so many years of my life have been spent trying to decipher the riddle of the music video to Total Eclipse of the Heart. Which, if you've never heard the song, it's one of the ultimate 80s bangers. Like, it's just huge and epic and catchy and unforgettable. If you've never seen the music video, pause the podcast. Watch it. It's like 5 minutes long. It's pretty long. But like,
it's like 8 minutes long.
Is it 8 minutes long?
It's pretty long.
It's long. It's long for a music video. It's short for anything else. Watch the music video. And as you're watching the music video, try to guess what's going to happen next. I dare you. Like, you will not guess everything that's going to happen over the course of this video. It's super weird. And when I found out it's about vampires, not only did the lyrics make more sense, but the music video makes more sense. Which, it still doesn't make sense, but it makes more sense. So, appreciated that. That changed my life. Xanadu. Is Xanadu underrated? A little. It's definitely not the worst thing ever. Like, a lot of people use it as like a punchline for so many years, though it's like the most embarrassing thing ever done. It was an attempt to marry the old school Hollywood musical, Gene Kelly is in it, with where music was at in 1980, which is unfortunately a very specific period in time in music. And it's not necessarily a period in time that is well thought of.
A lot of...
So it ends up feeling like a weird mishmash between this classical, timeless musical quality and this incredibly dated thing. And so as a result, the movie will always play weird.
Like, we're going to open our own roller disco. Those will be around forever.
Yeah. We got magical muses from ancient past. We've got Gene Kelly, one of the most iconic and long-lasting stars in Hollywood history, still one of the most recognizable actors from the Golden Age, and then roller disco.
Olivia Newton-John's roller disco.
Yeah, and one of those things is not like the other.
And Michael Beck as a painter. Yeah. It is a bad movie. I think a lot of the music is not interesting. There are some sequences I like. Everybody likes the Don Bluth animated sequence, and it's really well animated.
That bit's great.
And I actually like the dancing number, where they start with sort of a like World War II era big band sound, and they blend that with like some early 80s hair metal.
Yeah.
And physically, like, the two stages like move and blend together, and I think that's kind of an interesting bit.
I'll go bad for the soundtrack. I think Electric Light Orchestra did some really, really memorable music for that. Yeah. I've listened to that soundtrack on its own more times than I can literally count. I'm sure Spotify can count, but I can't. Seriously, there are like months have gone by where I listened to almost nothing else because I actually love Yellow, but anyway.
Does it function as a music review? No, because there's not enough music. I think if there was even less... less things in between the musical numbers, then maybe.
Yeah.
I
you can appreciate it as just, I like the musical numbers and everything in between. I don't give a crap, but it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
That's fine. I don't think that quite makes it a musical review, but I see what you're getting at, and it's an angle at which you can appreciate the movie, because at any other angle, you can't. And I think that's fair.
If there's
one way you want to look at a thing that makes you appreciate it, and it's not like putting your head in the sand and ignoring something like really toxic or shitty or something like that, then go for that. Mm. Knock yourself out. At least you found a way to enjoy a thing in a very earnest way. Good. And you stole my example of a movie that didn't work for me until I saw it from a new perspective, which is Batman and Robin is a good luchador movie.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't until Mark Edward Hoyk pointed out to me that I Know Who Killed Me is actually a giallo.
Yeah.
I watched it. I was like, this is just like a bonkers thriller. I don't understand this. But
once you look at it as an homage to Italian,
Very Italian movie, it's like, oh, actually, yeah, that's exactly what this is.
If Dario Argento made I Know Who Killed Me in 1979, it would be hailed as a horror classic.
Yeah.
But because it was an American filmmaker working with Lindsay Lohan in the 2000s, it swept the Razzies. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's about finding the right angle.
The Razzies are never fair.
No, but, I know, but like my point is that it got a bad reputation. It was a time when everyone was like dogpiling on like hating Lindsay Lohan for no good reason, and which is bullshit. And we all owe her a gigantic apology.
She owns a resort now.
Good for her.
Like she in order to flee the tabloids, she just sort of left the country and started hanging out on beaches and realized, no, I want to do this now.
Good for her.
Just I want to live on a beach. So seriously, she found her. I think it's called Lohan. I think it's in Greece.
Good. I would love to visit.
You can go to Lindsay Lohan's resort. I think it's in Greece.
But that's one where it's not about so much finding some weird angle that like maybe wasn't intended. I think that's the case. That's a case where we missed the point, or collectively we missed the point when it originally came out, and only later on were people willing to cut it some slack or consider maybe that perspective was short-sighted and try to ask what was the movie actually getting at. And that's something that I think, that's something, for example, that befell Starship Troopers, where when that movie came out, it was the studio presented it as this big action spectacle, a la Independence Day or some of the other giant, you know, sci-fi blockbusters of the time. And what they weren't talking about was how it's a satire of propaganda films, and it's actually very cynical about the Hollywood studio machine and the way that it presents the entertainment of war. That's an angle that people didn't by and large pick up on originally. They picked up on it pretty fast, but it was too late to save the movie at the box office. So that's another example, I think, where like it took people a minute to figure out like what they were actually doing.
A little. I think I was on that film's wavelength right away. It's the RoboCop guy. It's the same tone as RoboCop.
Yeah, well, Jupiter Ascending is another I think Jupiter Ascending is another one where if you look at it not as like this big action spectacle from the directors of The Matrix, but if you look at it as an elaborate sci-fi satire of The Princess Diaries, where, oh, yeah, it turns out you, a scullery maid, are actually a royalty, and you're going to get to inherit the entire planet Earth. And this is our excuse to give you a really complicated look at why the whole economic system of the universe is fucked. Really fucked. And if you look at it from that perspective, that's actually a really interesting sci-fi movie. Yeah. If you look at it as brainless spectacle, it's not, because it's not brainless. It's actually,
there's a lot to it.
It's actually kind of an interesting treatise. And then what was the
and that's not a bad performance.
Eddie Redmayne.
Eddie Redmayne. That's a brilliant performance. Eddie Redmayne is not giving a bad performance. He's giving a very, very good performance.
He's doing that on purpose. He was told to do that. He represents the absolute evils at the absolute pinnacle, the unapologetic exploitation of people in an economic system, and they're not pretending that that has nuance. They're telling you that is evil. There's a really distinct point to that. It's not a great movie in some respects, because it's just, it's clunky and it's overstuffed, but like the actual messages of it and the idea behind it are really strong, and I will defend Jupiter Ascending a lot. I think it's a really interesting film.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's another example right there. Thank you for that. And if anyone can think of that, I guess it's a war movie, please let us know. It sounds really twisted. Yeah, doesn't ring a bell right now. All right, moving on.
Here's a letter from Shad. Hello, Shad.
Hi, Shad.
Dear Booms Whitney, I'd like to present to you with the pitch
okay.
for your next great Cancel Too Soon series.
Okie dokie.
The Cancel Too Soon Mysteries. Logline. Okay. William Bibbs Bibiani and Whitney Seibold are former critics who now teach film and TV courses at a small Midwestern college.
Ow.
They also solve mysteries. They use their encyclopedic knowledge of film and TV to solve crimes and stump the local police. Characters. William Bibbs Bibiani. Bibbs is always handy with a pun at the scene of a crime. He'll say things like, he'll never get ahead in life after finding a headless corpse.
Oh.
These puns will frequently proceed to a commercial break. Or sometimes we'll be in the cold open. Can you put on shades like in CSI Miami?
I'll just take my glasses off and put them back on again.
Bibbs will also have the catchphrase, everyone's critic. Then he'll, when his theories get questioned, Bibbs is frequently experimenting with soap making. And while they usually turn out well, he'll sometimes be working on one that totally grosses out everyone.
Okay.
Character Whitney Seibold.
Mm.
Throughout the series, people will sometimes call Whitney Rockmeister McCool. He will not respond well to this and will always say, I'm not that guy anymore. And this will never be explained. He'll also reference films that no one but Bibbs has ever heard of. And sometimes not even Bibbs will have heard of them. Whitney's catchphrase is, oh golly, when startled or shocked at something. Like Bibbs, he is prone to puns and bad jokes. This is true. Dean Fussler, the dean of Bibbs and Whitney's department, will frequently be annoyed at them solving mysteries when they should be teaching. Frequently in episodes, he will always catch them doing something they shouldn't, but Bibbs and Whitney will always be a step ahead. Chief Werner, the chief of police, who will never understand how they solved crimes before Bibbs and Whitney arrived in town. He was always affable and generally glad for the help. Doc Pierce, the medical examiner that Bibbs and Whitney consult with often. He's total cliche, wisecracking, eats over the bodies, and does things that make our duo a little nauseous sometimes. I love the wisecracking pathologist. Thank you for including it. And finally, Luca.
Yay!
Bibbs' cat, who will mostly serve as comic relief. Occasionally will do something that causes a revelation about the crime. Thank you, Luca, for helping.
Mm.
There's a list of 6 episodes. Number 1, Pitch, the pilot, introduces the characters, deals with the murder of a baseball pitcher from the college team. Bibbs and Whitney know little about sports, so awkwardness ensues. No, I know enough about baseball.
I don't.
I know a little bit about. Okay, no, nothing about baseball.
Yeah, I know there's a ball in it.
I'm not going to flout my ignorance about baseball. Yeah. I'm a little embarrassed that I don't know more about organized sport.
I know that on first base, you hold hands.
Oh, is that first base?
That's first base.
Yeah, in what, 1949?
Yeah.
You hold hands, that's first base?
That's first base.
Sure.
What?
Look, clearly you're not a youth in 2021.
Never said I was.
Number 2, Profit. A local banker is killed in front of his own vault. Number 3, Baffled. A psychic is killed, and the police turn to Bibbs and Whitney when they run out of leads.
I thought I was going to say, a psychic is killed in front of her own vault.
What? Number 4, Doubt. Police have their man, or do they? Bibbs and Whitney have their theories and race to save an innocent man. Number 5, Cop Rock. Notice these are all names of Cancel Too Soon shows. Pitch, Profit, Baffled. Cop Rock, a police officer that's murdered is revealed to be the lead singer of a punk band. Is it an old case or a bad gig that got him killed? And The 100 Lives, Ellipsis. A magician slash escape artist is accidentally killed when a trick goes wrong, or was it murder? Were there more episodes? Maybe. I'll leave that up to you if you want to come up with more, if you want to open it up to listeners for some more. Thank you for all that you do. I know that this comes from a place of admiration and respect. Sincerely, Shad.
Shad, thank you for that. That's
funny. That's very funny.
No, I've never, it's not, I don't know if that technically qualifies as fan fiction, but it's close enough for me. That's very, very flattering. I'm disappointed that in this universe, neither of us are married anymore.
we do have wives.
You have family, you have a son.
No.
So that's going to be, these are characters that will need to be addressed. But that's a fun idea. I've actually toyed with, on many occasions, and we've talked about it on Twitter, wanting to write a series of cozy mysteries about a film critic in a small town. And sometimes when I'm feeling wistful or depressed, I'll tweet about, I just want to get a job at a liberal arts college in a small Midwestern town and occasionally solve mysteries. it's such a fun framework for a show or a series of books. And I've toyed about doing something with it so many times. And you've clearly, done the work for me, because that's actually really good. Mm-hmm. and now I can never use any of that material. Thank you. That's a hoot. And I'm trying to think of what we would... if you and I actually, like, found a dead body...
Mm.
I think we take a crack at it. Why not? Like, we'd at least give it a one. We'd at least give it a look-see.
Well, rather than being a series, we'd be in just this really kind of embarrassing indie film where we're two film critics. We find a body and we try to solve the mystery, and it just like ruins our lives. It's like, no, I'm investigating. What are you doing? You're under arrest. You're not allowed to do that.
Yeah,
that's against the law.
Well, what if I escape and solve the crime to prove my innocence?
This is not a TV show.
Why would you do that?
I'm just going to arrest you again. Yeah. We spend most of our time
even if you
prison.
Solved the crime, you like evaded the police and stuff, it'd be bad. One thing I love about all those like Murder, She Wrote type mystery shows is the absolute lack of confidence in the police's ability to do anything useful.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole premise, is the police can't do it, only... Angela Lansbury can't.
Mm.
Thank you, Angela Lansbury, for just exposing the incompetence at the heart and, of a lot of police departments.
And starting on May 20th, you can watch the Mapleworth murders again.
Oh yeah, it was a Quibi show.
It was a Quibi show, and all the Quibi shows on the 20th of May of this year.
Yeah.
You'll be able to watch on Roku.
Basically tomorrow, as of when this episode debuts.
So yeah, be sure to watch the Mapleworth murders. It's amusing. It's not a great comedy, but there's a lot of really interesting cameos. They got a lot of big stars to be in it.
It's a satire of those kinds of
it's a spoof of like Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a lot of fun. Mm. And if we couldn't play ourselves,
who would play us?
See you.
Well, I'd get that worst week guy who looks like me.
That
actor.
I was going to go with Rafe Spall.
I'll take Rafe Spall.
Yeah.
Let me look up the actor from Worst. There's a TV series that we're going
to
cover at
some
point.
We keep meaning to cover it. It's been forever.
It was called Worst Week, and the lead actor in Worst Week, like, his name is Carl Bornheimer.
Mm.
Kyle Bornheimer just looks a little bit like me.
And I have to say this, your dad is going to be played by Hart Bachner.
Yes, absolutely. Get Hart Bachner in here.
The guy from Die Hard. Anyway, I don't know who to blame me. Anyway, we got time for one more. Yeah, we got time for
all
one
right,
more.
Here's a letter from Thomas.
Hi, Thomas.
Hello, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. I was recently listening to a new episode of Critically Acclaimed, and I want to thank you. Thank you for bringing up the film Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Yay!
I remember that movie from my teenage years, and I swear to you that it had been completely forgotten about. While I never really thought of it as a good movie, it amazes me that no one I know seems to remember its existence. It had a bunch of noteworthy actors in it. It was regularly played on cable after it came out, but for some reason it was never brought up or referenced for anything.
Mm.
Now to the point of my question, what are some tropes or traits in movies that make them become forgotten when they are things that shouldn't... when things shouldn't let that happen? Some forgotten movies have big actors or directors, or received a wide release or advertising budget, but still drift out of human consciousness. Hoping you guys can help me with this query of mine. Thanks for all the work you do, Thomas.
Why are big movies forgotten?
Is the real question here.
First off, regarding Drop Dead Gorgeous. Drop Dead Gorgeous, if anyone is listening is unfamiliar with it, is a really funny sort of post Waiting for Guffman look at sort of teen beauty pageants.
Right.
A lot of wacky characters. It's genuinely very, very funny. It wasn't a huge hit, but it's one of those movies that everyone who saw it really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it doesn't get referenced a lot, it's one of those movies where every time you bring it up in conversation, everyone who's seen it goes, yeah! for a long time. These are typically movies that eventually become cult hits.
Yeah.
For a long time, this was Galaxy Quest. Mm. Galaxy Quest was a movie that kind of came and went. It did okay, but every time if no one brought it up in conversation, but if you actually did, everyone would quote it because they really liked it. And now I think it's more or less an established sci-fi comedy classic, maybe on the lower end, but like it's up there. And I think that's coming someday for Drop Dead Gorgeous, because everyone I know who's actually seen it is really loves it.
Drop Dead Gorgeous already has that. It's been celebrated in retrospectives. It's made
It has retrospectives?
Yeah, absolutely. It's made its rounds on the Midnight Circuit.
Really? Yeah. I missed that round on the Midnight Circuit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
okay. I missed it.
About a decade
ago. Right.
Yeah,
It already did it.
It already did it, and it's moved through the consciousness. And
It's still a little quiet. As cult movies go.
All right.
Obviously, our reader missed
it. I saw it when it came out. I think it came out in 99. And I remember thinking it was amusing.
Very charming.
I didn't think it was really kind of groundbreaking in any kind of significant way. But, I liked it.
Yeah. I think it's fun.
It definitely has a cult. It has a really big queer cult. So that's a big part of it. And, it actually is pretty well regarded now. Yeah. I think it's been rescued.
As for the question, why are movies that seem like they're going to be a big deal, why do they become forgotten? And that's a good question.
Availability is a big part of it.
Big part of it.
If people don't keep on talking about it, then they're just going to go away. And that can happen to anything. If they stop making DVDs of Ghostbusters and take it off of streaming, Ghostbusters will vanish.
Yep.
Yeah, older fans of it will remember it and talk about it.
And then eventually they'll just sort of fade away, and then we won't talk about it anymore. There are so many gigantic blockbuster movies from the 30s, 40s, silent era onward that nobody talks about anymore just because they're not available anymore, and that's just not a thing.
The Dead End Kids.
Yeah,
Little Rascals, the Blondie movies, the Francis the Talking Mule. These things were all huge hits in their day, and because
Billy Jack,
because they're not being constantly celebrated, they do tend to fade away, and this can happen fast.
Yeah,
one of our favorite movies, we talk about this movie a lot, is Master and Commander: The Far Side of the World.
Yeah,
the Peter Weir film from 2003, and. That movie, it got a proper DVD release, but I think because of some weird fluke, I think the print runs were really low on that film. Like, there weren't a lot of DVDs put out on it, and it just never sort of made a lot of rounds on cable stations. It's a little long. I think it's 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's about this really dry material about, maritime warships, and it's maybe a little bit of a tough sell when you're trying to book, like, blocks of programming on cable television.
Right.
And as such, you couldn't find it. It disappeared really quick. It went off the market real fast. I don't know if it's on any streaming services now even, it is a legit great movie.
Yeah.
It should be talked about. It should be watched a lot. I was really happy when Sneakers made its way onto Paramount Plus, and like
I think it was HBO Max.
Have you seen this movie Sneakers? Yeah, I saw it. I've been talking about it constantly. Haven't you been listening? Have you been listening to me?
I was mildly offended.
Yeah.
I was like, we've been talking up this movie for our entire careers, and you're only just now watching it. Why? Because it's now available easily.
Yeah.
It's just right there. Like, it's easy to get to. This is one of the reasons why we get frustrated when classic movies or just older movies are not available on big streaming services. Because simply having them available makes it possible for people to discover them again. If they're not available, people don't know to look for them, they're not going to get found by most folks. More people are going to stumble onto Sneakers just for the sheer fact that it's on HBO Max than would ever have gone hunting for the DVD randomly.
Master and Commander is on Prime right now.
Good.
So if you have a Prime subscription, watch Master and Commander: The Far Side of the World.
But to that point, I mean, think about how many like blockbusters from the 70s, for example, are not talked about today.
The Towering
Inferno, gigantic blockbuster, all-star, nominated for Best Picture. When was the last time you heard someone talk about it? They don't. It's not because it was an insignificant film. It was a very significant film. But it's gone. And availability is a big part of it. It's just not shown a lot. It's not talked about a lot. But beyond that, I do think there are other reasons. And I think sometimes it's the reasons why things cease to be available is because a lot of them are generic. There's a lot of generic movies regardless of movies that were hits. Think about movies that seemed like they were going to be hits. Here's a movie I think about a lot, actually. I want to make sure I get the cast right or the director right. The movie City Hall.
Oh, yeah, I remember City
1996,
Hall.
1996, City Hall, this big, high...
it's a big prestige picture.
Big prestige thing. It's getting late, and my words are failing me. It's a big prestige picture from director Harold Becker, who did Sea of Love and did Malice. It was not an insignificant film. It did Taps, The Onion Field. And it starred Al Pacino, John Cusack, Danny Aiello, Martin Landau, Richard Schiff, Bridget Fonda, David Paymer. Like this good, solid, impressive cast. It was co-written by Paul Schrader. You ever heard of it?
I saw it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We need to work so this our city, this city, can be a palace again.
Wow. Okay, you remember the trailer, yeah? Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, it's just it didn't do anything that made a splash. It didn't. Well, it never felt like an event. It felt like just this sort of slapdash attempt at respectability, and then it just went on its way. It didn't like become a story.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of it. The movies that we remember, the movies that we still write think pieces about, are movies that themselves feel like an event, feel like a story, feel like a happening. And I think that's a big part of it.
And I think another big part of it is the films that we tend to talk about a lot and revisit a lot are ones that still fall in line with our current interests. If we are interested in a certain genre, we're going to be delving back in that genre.
Yeah.
Because we're not making a lot of disaster movies now, we're not going to talk about the disaster movies of the past.
That's a fair point.
Because we're focused on a lot of like sort of fantasy and effects-driven movies now as blockbusters, those are the biggest entertainments right now, we tend to look back on the past and remember just the effects-driven blockbusters. As such, you ask anybody what the best films of the 1980s were, they're all going to be effects-driven blockbusters. Those are the ones that are most commonly mentioned.
You occasionally get someone in Amadeus in there, but like a lot of them will be.
Yeah, but
Gremlins, Ghostbusters, Who Framed
Roger
Rabbit.
When was the last time somebody mentioned Out of Africa, or Hannah and Her Sisters, or Fitzcarraldo? You know, these films that...
People will say Top Gun. Top Gun turns 35 this year.
Top Gun is a piece of shit.
I think it might be a slight exaggeration, but it's not that great.
Top Gun is not good, I'll just say that.
It's thinly disguised pro-military propaganda. It's
super pro-military
propaganda. And that's not in and of itself the worst thing ever, but that's kind of all it is. That's my point. It's shallow.
Planes
are sex. That's the metaphor. They're all having
wieners up in the sky.
And instead of sounding like planes actually sound, they like put like the growls of like jungle cats just so that it would sound more like virile and masculine.
Thanks, Tony Scott.
Yeah.
Because
I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying I don't think it's good.
So nostalgia and things that fall in line with what we're currently interested in are the films that are going to be remembered most vividly.
That's a good point.
Whereas great films that belong to genres we're not familiar with anymore, or that our parents were watching when we were young, are the films that aren't going to get as much attention. However great they might be.
Yeah.
And however big hits they were. I mean, we don't really talk about something like Three Men and a Baby or a lot of the big comedies of the 1980s.
Three Men and a Baby was a monster.
Comedies aren't big money right now.
Three Men and a Baby outgrossed gigantic motion. Three Men and a Baby outgrossed Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
It was the highest grossing film of that year.
Yeah.
And
it was ridiculous.
It was 87 or 88 that movie came out.
And that was a good year for cinema, too.
Yeah, there was also films like Look Who's Talking and Crocodile Dundee. Yeah. These were like Coming to America, even.
Has a bit more of a culture. Yeah. Actually, I think Eddie Murphy helps with that.
You're right. But
Because Eddie Murphy didn't go anywhere. Eddie Murphy
Comedies used to be huge business, but because we're not making comedies now, or at least when we do, they're really sort of understated comedies or indie comedies. They're not the things that are making the huge amount of money. We don't tend to think of those comedy films as the best of all time, do we?
No.
So those ones have faded a little bit in estimation. Yeah. And depending on how trends are going to change in the present is going to directly affect the kind of films we talk about from the past.
Yeah. So really the big things here are availability is a huge part of it. Is contemporary cinema pointing people backwards in that direction? Not necessarily. And sometimes they're just not that remarkable. That's just a fact. Just because the movie's old, just because the movie has a good cast,
just because it made a lot of money when it opened,
whether or not it made a lot of money, sometimes it's just not as good as all that. Like if you watch Turner Classic Movies 24 hours a day, like I used to, but back when I had time, you realize that just because the movie's old doesn't necessarily make it a classic. Sometimes it's just old. It doesn't mean it's not interesting. Doesn't mean it's not, like, you can learn a lot from it. Doesn't mean it isn't necessarily fun. But, yeah, not every movie from the 1940s is It's a Wonderful Life or The Best Years of Our Lives. Sometimes they're crap. And that's true for anything. It's true for any art form.
They've always made crap.
There's every bookstore is full of crap. Every music store or delivery service or whatever you use is full of crap. Every movie, every video store, every streaming service is full of crap. Like that doesn't mean it's all bad crap. Doesn't mean it's not worth watching. But let's be honest here.
Some of it's not worth watching.
There's hundreds, if not thousands, of movies that are released every single year. They're not all going to get remembered. They're not all going to last. Sometimes they'll be remembered for a short while, and then a few decades later, they'll evaporate. Yeah. There will come a day, maybe not soon, but there will come a day when Star Wars is obscure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to happen. Maybe not in our lifetimes.
If they stop,
but it'll happen.
They stop making new movies.
Yeah.
And they stop, if websites stop writing about them, it'll become this.
If they stop making money, boom, done.
And if our interests move away from science fiction adventure movies, which can happen. I'm not going to say that these things are permanent. Just because they've been a part of our conversation for, all of our lifetimes doesn't mean they're going to continue that way.
Yeah.
Same with the Avengers movies. Yeah. They will be obscure someday.
Like Tarzan used to be a gigantic motion picture series of blockbusters. Used to be a popular character. Not a lot of Tarzan out there. Yeah. He's fading.
Yeah. Oh, here
it will happen.
Here it is. I found it. And somebody once put together a graph. I'll show it to William here. It's a graph of just what's available on the biggest streaming services.
Yeah, and from what era?
Decade by decade, and you'll find that. Most of them are the 2010s are most
very well
represented, and the further back in time you go, the smaller and smaller the slivers get. So by the time you get to before 1970, any film before 1970, this is decades of film.
That's the majority of the history of film.
It only represents teeny tiny slivers of what's available on streaming services. Disney Plus has the biggest slice of the main streaming services, and that's just because they continue to market their animated films from the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, and some of the live action stuff too. But yeah, that's fair enough. But anyway, that's a thank you for the good question. I hope we answered it somewhat effectively. We record these quite late, and sometimes I'm just like, you know what, I'm tired. I don't know if I'm even coherent sometimes until I listen to the podcast the next morning. I hope we answered that one well. And thank you everybody for writing in. If you want to write in for a future episode of We've Got Mail, you can write to us at letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We would love to hear from you. Feel free to ask us questions, send us recommendations. If you want to answer some of the questions that have been asked on this episode, especially the ones that we weren't able to figure out, please send those along, and we'll try to boost that. We'll talk about that in next episode or episode after, whenever we get them. You're also welcome to follow us on Twitter. We are at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I am at Whitney Seibold.
If you want to go over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you'll get a lot of exclusive shows, including if you want to look back at the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club that is still available. You got to search for it because it's way back in our listings, but it's there. And you can hear us do that Lonesome Dove miniseries or a lot of other TV movies. But we currently have shows about every single episode of the 1960s Batman, every single episode of Star Trek, every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We're doing commentary tracks, films that should be on Disney Plus but mysteriously are not. A lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And we thank every single one of our patrons, without whom we wouldn't be doing this. This would not be possible. So thank you, every single one of you. In particular, and if you can't afford to be a patron and you want to help out the show, please subscribe if you haven't already. Leave a review wherever you find us. That really helps a lot. Just a star rating, even just a sentence. Be honest. We wouldn't tell you otherwise. But just that level of engagement, like, really, really helps us, like, go up in the algorithms and find new listeners, and that helps us out a lot. That's cool. Yeah. Head on over to Etsy.com. Look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You can see a selection of fine handcrafted soaps by my wife and partner, M. Lopez da Silva, and myself. M. Lopez da Silva also has a novel called Hooker, which is a retro-wave vigilante slasher thriller novel. Feminist, pro-sex work, pro-queer, very subversive to a variety of genres, and the reviews have been excellent. So you can find that novel wherever fine books are sold. If they don't have it, request it. They'll order it for you. That's it.
Support your local bookstore.
Support your local bookstore. Support your local artisans. And that's it. Thank you very much once again. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney. Crime Solvers.